Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here with us today. Well, not actually here with us. I mean, digitally here with us. James Fell joining us, I think, from somewhere in Calgary. We're here to talk about his new book, The Holy Shit Moment, How Lasting Change Can Happen in an Instant. James, thank you for taking the time to hang out with me online today.
Oh, you're very welcome, David. And you just answered one of my questions out of the gate is, Is it okay to swear on your podcast? You said the full title of the book, so I guess we're all right on that one.
So that's no, absolutely. you know, let's maybe we keep it to a dull roar. Is that okay?
Yeah. I'll be good.
That's right. Yeah. No, that's fine if it's going to help to you know, make a point or get us across the finish line. Then I'm all for it. So how do you? That's a funny question to start right in on. I mean, I've got so many questions. And by the way, congratulations on the book. A wonderful read. Anything talking about change for me grabs my eye, and I hope you sell a million of these. This is
so do I.
And it's been out a week today, so yes. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. But just on that level, how do you refer to it when you're talking about the book? If you're not allowed to swear, what do you say? The holy moment?
Well, so this was a concern that I had when I was talking to my publisher, saying, you know, what are we going to do? And she said, yeah, somebody will figure it out for us. And it was CBC Radio that did it first. I went on the Alberta Noon show that I'd done many times before. And the producer came out and said, yeah, so we're just going to refer to it as the holy S moment. And I said, yeah, that sounds fine. That sounds good. And then she explained that while she was introducing me, saying that's not the actual title of the book, that's the cleaned up version. The title has, you know, the full four letter word, so use your imagination. And, you know, people understand what it is. I was on a radio call this morning that was just with this very interesting man in Rhode Island that was referring to it as the holy feces moment.
The holy feces moment. Very funny.
And I thought, okay, you know, I'd just rather you said S. That would be fine, but whatever.
Yeah, I think actually that's a whole other book.
Yeah, I think it is. The sacred excrement moment, maybe. I don't know.
Yes. I guess S could stand for scatological, I suppose. Yeah. I'm guessing right now listeners are wondering, where, pray tell, is this interview going?
I don't know yet. I guess we'll find out.
So I'm going to read something here about Chuck. Quote, "The bat to Chuck's skull was what ended his life, metaphorically speaking. I tell people I died that day. The old Chuck is dead. I killed him." Chuck's realization that he had to change happened in an instant when he knew he had to become not just the father his child needed, but the husband his wife deserved. Yet Chuck didn't stop thinking there. The powerful aha moment brought additional clarity to who he was and how he needed to change. Close quote. Those are your words from the holy S moment. Tell us a little bit about the book. Tell us a little bit about your theory of change, I suppose, and what got you here. And why you would even want us to know about Chuck?
Well, having worked in health and fitness and weight loss and approaching it from a motivational perspective for many years, that was what I had been writing about for a long time. One of the things you notice, there are so many different ways to adopt physical activity. And there's so many different diets that a person that can go on. But it's an industry that wants to sell you some type of miracle weight loss solution based on, you know, this is the best diet, this is the best exercise regimen. And it's all crap. It's whatever appeals to that person the most. And in Chuck's example, he weighed over 400 pounds and had tried and failed to lose weight many times. And then because of a transformative experience, he was suddenly overwhelmingly motivated, where he knew that this time it was going to be successful. There's another quote in that chapter directly from Chuck where he said, "I didn't have to struggle with my motivation. It came built in." And the reason why is that he was no longer focusing on the behaviors, the actions that he had to take in order to lose weight, but he transformed at a core level of his identity and his values, where what happens when you go through that identity change, you read about how, you know, the old Chuck was dead, that all of your actions and behaviors just sync up in line, so that moving forward, it seems like it's effortless, because what was once drudgery now comes to feel like this is your destiny that needs to be fulfilled. And that is one of the big problems that we see with behavior change, is that the focus is on the behavior rather than your core identity. And we talk about micro changes to slowly develop habits where you drag yourself over some type of a motivational tipping point where you can just develop a routine via, you know, grit and discipline, and it becomes sticky. And yes, that approach does work, and I don't throw it out completely, but the adherence rates are not so great. And one of the reasons why I decided to look into this book as an idea was because I had experienced something like this, a transformative event, a holy shit moment that really changed my life. And I'd done some research and talked to people and found out that many other people had as well, that there was a completely different way to approach behavior change, where if you had some type of peak experience that altered your identity, all of a sudden, you may discover that those behaviors that you've been struggling to change via baby steps suddenly become an effortless shift of mindset, where you're driven to do this, and it's like this, you become unstoppable.
James, is this, I mean, I have so many questions. I love everything I'm hearing, by the way. Can you get to that epiphany? Can you get to that moment without some of those baby steps before? So, you know, I used to have a friend who would say, you know, take the people that you've met in the past 10 or 15 or 20 years out of your life, all the crazy situations you've had, the places you've been, and you would not be the person you are today. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you can have those sort of baseball bats to the back of the head without having gone through X, Y, and Z before. Does that make sense?
All of us have the ability to have one, you know, today, right now, because of our past life experiences. It's something that pops up from the unconscious based on our, you know, all of the RAM memory that's floating around in our gray matter that has a tendency to gel in a profound way all of a sudden, because there's two different types of systems of thinking. There's the slower system two thinking, that is the rational methodical approach, and then there's the very rapid system one thinking, where an idea just suddenly pops into consciousness from the subconscious. So there's the people that have it literally popping out of existence seemingly out of nowhere. And I say seemingly because it was residing below the surface in their unconscious, and then it's the pieces of the puzzle suddenly all coming together. This is what human creativity is known for, that you have this eureka moment, right, where suddenly the answer is delivered to you. And it might be an answer about some type of mechanical problem you're working on, or a piece of musical composition, or something, you know, how to solve a problem at work. But it can also be about, what do I do with the rest of my life? Where do I find the motivation to alter my health, or some type of, should I go back to school, or how should I solve this problem in my relationship, or even my mood state, the way I feel about myself? These types of eureka moments can apply to literally anything about the way that we move through our lives.
Isn't this what a moment of discovery is for a scientist? All these years of knowledge and study and papers and lectures all come to that moment where they put it all together subconsciously, or Michael Polanyi actually would call it indwelling. Like they've just lived this stuff for so long that all of a sudden, bam, it's the baseball bat.
Yes, and or the lightning strike, or, you know, whatever it is that you want to call it. But there's different ways to approach it that you can help push it along as well. So the information may already be there. I think it was Maslow who came up with the hierarchy of needs, which isn't something that we really use that much in psychological circles, but it does get referenced a lot. But he referred to them as peak experiences, and that we already have capacities and talents and missions and callings and information that we can use to have this peak experience. However, you may need to do some pre-work to help initiate this, because say it, I like using weight loss as an example, not because I think it applies to everyone or everyone should consider it, but It's because it's one of those things that's really hard to do. It's exceptionally challenging for people to follow through on. And once you lose the weight in order to keep it off, you know, we see that the adherence rates are very low. And it may be that that you need to engage in some of that baby steps, be a tortoise, not a hare approach, in order to have the sudden realization that this is something that that, you know, you can be very motivated to do. Like the example of Leslie in the introduction, the fencer, who she slogged at fencing for a couple of months, not really enjoying it, not feeling like this was anything that was of importance to her. And then during class one day, she had that sudden transformative experience where she realized, I'm going to get as good at this as I possibly can. And 10 years later, won that silver medal at the North American level. The way that I look at motivation is that it's like a mountain, where if you have absolutely no motivation to do anything to work toward a goal, you're down at the base of the mountain.
Two things. One, my son has been doing some fencing over the last couple of years. He's 13 years old. So yeah, I couldn't help but smile at that. And there's something about it, you know, and I don't know if there's a connection here or not, but there's a precision, right, to fencing. I don't know if you've ever done it. My wife and I, Elizabeth, did once. Yes. And it's crazy talk, by the way. I mean, it is a workout. Like, it is so challenging to get through it. But I'm one couple questions in here. There's something about the precision there. And then I wonder, like, as in Leslie's case, I mean, the eureka moment, the lightning bolt got her to the work that she had to do. Yeah. Like, she still had to do all this work. I mean, it was all the motivation, get out of bed early, practice, rehearse, know your opponent, and so on. So it's not just the defining moment that matters. It's the defining moment that gets you to what's next.
And it's the follow through of realizing that yes, there is all of this work that you have to do, but it's not drudgery. It's you're looking forward to it. It's something that
there,
you feel
there's life in it.
Driven to do.
There's life in the work.
Exactly. And back to the mountain analogy. So if you have no motivation to work toward this goal, you're at the base of the mountain, and the peak of the mountain would represent 100% motivation to do all of the work with inspired vigor. Now, if you're down at the base of the mountain and you think, okay, well, this is a goal that you would like to pursue, you don't just sit there hanging out at the base waiting for sudden inspiration to arrive and materialize you at the top. Sometimes that does happen, but it is more effective if you do that baby steps approach of start hiking a while, and you're acting like a tortoise, but you're thinking like a hare, where you could be transported either to the peak of motivational mountain, or at least much closer to the top along the way. That these are things that can work in conjunction with one another. I don't throw out the whole slow and steady approach. I actually recommend it while being attuned to the possibility of seeing a massive leap in your motivation.
Is it really just about choice? Is this an existential decision that this is about getting out of bed in the morning for all the right reasons?
You know, I don't think it's so much a decision as it is a sudden awakening. In some ways, so it's coming from you, but at the same time, it feels like it's happening to you. Choice is not a great word, because when you feel overwhelmingly compelled that I must do this, choice kind of goes out the window. And that's one of the reasons why they're so incredibly motivating, because it's like a sudden passion unleashed, where we've gone from just making rational decisions. Oh, this seems like, you know, based on this mathematical analysis of the scenario, I have decided that the most logical decision is for me to do this. Well, that's not terribly inspiring. That's, you know, it's not one of those things where that really has a tendency to drive people forward. When we start involving our emotional decision-making processes, which is the way that we actually do make decisions, is the way that we feel about them, because our brains aren't supercomputers. We have a tendency to make decisions based on their emotional value because of the way that our brains work. And when we really embrace that sort of gut feel that isn't really in the gut, it's more in your subconscious, that drives us to say, this is what you have to do, and you engage those emotional drivers, then suddenly it's like, all right, this has got to happen. I mean, I feel like I will die if I don't do this.
Yeah, you can't not do this.
Exactly. It was, you know, when I had my big one in my 20s, but I've had other clarifying ones, like when I decided that I was going to leave my business career and become a writer. I was overwhelmingly driven to do so. It was one of those things where I'd never worked so hard at something in my life. I had a successful business career that I worked moderately hard at because it paid the bills. But when I decided to become a writer, I was overwhelmingly driven to pursue this and be as successful as I could.
I want to talk about those single life defining moments, as you call them. But I also want to just touch on epiphany. You know, for me, I guess, and maybe others, it doesn't have to be this, but it definitely seems to have a religious edge to it or connotation. Can you talk about that? Because that's clearly not you do speak about it.
Yes.
In fact, you talk about prayer. You talk about, you know, you talk about some very specific things with respect to that. Can you talk a little bit about this sort of broader, I guess, approach you have?
Yes. Yeah, so it's historically speaking that the term epiphany does have a lot of religious connotations with it, because, you know, we see myriad examples of it in religious texts such as, you know, Saul of Tarsus, who saw the burning bush and became Paul the Apostle. And there's just so many examples where we think about a religious epiphany where you were spoken to by God or an angel or some other worldly type of presence. And those people have those types of epiphanies today where they believe that there's a woman in the book who had a near-death experience in a hospital room where, you know, she did die and was brought back to life and had that type of religious otherworldly epiphany. There was another man who had been diagnosed with MS, and then the religious experience that he had after that. And so that is what is called a mystical type of epiphany. Excuse me. But there's also the insightful type. And the ones that I've experienced are more insightful in nature, where it's the answering of a question, where it's that creative brain going into overdrive, where you've had this problem in your life. And maybe you didn't even know that you had the problem, but maybe it was in nagging at you subconsciously, where you just kind of knew something wasn't right, or there were a number of little problems that sort of achieved totality. It's called crystallization of discontent, where you reach something akin to a breaking point, and suddenly the solution to the problem is presented to you, where it's like, this is the answer. And it comes with an overwhelming sense of rightness, because you've been waiting for this. And then here it comes, boom, you instantly know that this is the right thing that you have to do. There's a deep emotional wave because you're happy. It's like, hooray, this is the answer. These problems are going to go away because now I know how to fix them. So that's the insightful type. The mystical type is more rooted in someone having a type of religious experience, that it doesn't have to be necessarily associated with any individual type of faith. You know, it can happen to someone who is an atheist, but they just have some type of experience. And the thing is that it doesn't matter what your individual beliefs are, that God does not have to exist in order for a person to have this type of experience, because we know that people have these experiences, that they believe that God or an angel or whatever said, this is what you have to do, or, you know, it's just a sense of peace.
Right.
And we don't know what's on the other end of it.
It
happens.
It's the catalyst.
Yeah. The reality is that people have these experiences and they're profound for that person, and they change that person's life. Whether or not the causation of it was otherworldly or no, we don't know. And it doesn't really matter, because the experience still happened for that person.
So, okay. So I'm 53. Let's say, I'm married. I'm meandering along. I don't think, and maybe you would challenge me on this if you were interviewing me, let's say, I don't really feel like I've had a single life-defining moment, mm-hmm. and yet I don't feel quite satisfied. You know, you talk about happiness and Aristotle later in the book, which certainly got my attention, and I'd love mm-hmm. to chat some more about that too, but what's going to get me there? Is, you know, you talk about mindfulness, you talk about being open to experiences, and I mean, wonderful advice and things that we need to do. What's my, is it a couple of shots of vodka in a row? Is that going to get me on the right track here, James? What are we talking about?
Well, from a very big picture perspective, and I don't know what it is that you do in your spare time, but I know that most people seem to have developed a fear about being alone with their thoughts, that we see that I don't want to be one of those old curmudgeons. You know, you spend too much time on your fancy little internet box in your hand there. But I think that there is tremendous value in unplugging, because this type of epiphany will not take place if you're distracted with something else that commands your attention. You need to instead be in an environment where your attention can be seduced by your surroundings. Shower thoughts are a great one. Now they're making waterproof phones so people don't ever have to put their phone down. They can take their phone in the shower, and they're missing out. I had a great shower thought just yesterday about another book idea. And so shower thoughts are very powerful, because as long
that
as
should be, by the way, that should be the title of your next book, Shower Thoughts. Yeah.
That you're away from technological distraction. It's not an intellectually demanding task. It's something, you know, you're going through motions that you've done thousands of times before. You don't have to think about it. You've got the white noise effect of the water. It's comfortable. You're in a relaxed state. So we can have all sorts of great, you know, there's an example of a woman in the book that was considering suicide, and it was because of a shower thought that dramatically changed her life, that said, this is what you have to do. And it took her from wanting to end her life to now living a great life because of the mission that was delivered to her in the shower. And we've got great thinkers across the ages extolling the virtues of a walk in nature by themselves. They weren't, no offense, David, they weren't listening to podcasts while they were out on that walk.
Right.
And,
yep.
You know, they weren't looking at their phone. They weren't listening to an audiobook. That they were just listening to the sounds of nature, the birds and the rustle of the leaves and the wind and that type of thing, and just letting their minds wander. That's the thing that people need to be able to do, that it happens while you're permitting your mind to wander.
Why are we so afraid of our thoughts? I mean, is this a nice circle back to sort of your initial comment about, I mean, my sense is your initial comment was about being okay with who we are. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked a little, I mean, the book is about self-awareness, it seems to mm-hmm. me, and about being able to shine that light, you know, onto our, not navel gazing, but shine it inside, I suppose, and say, I'm okay with who I am. And is that why we're afraid of walking alone in the forest without a podcast playing in our ears?
I think that there's a fear of boredom and there has been research showing that, you know, that little Facebook-like number that pops up gives you a little hit of dopamine, because, you know, you get the approval of others that said they liked your witty post or, you know, the photo of your dog or something like that, that we're attention seekers. So there's a fear that we will, you know, maybe be bored, or people won't pay attention to us, or we won't get that little positive reinforcement of approval from others. And I think that people just need to be able to realize that, you know, if you can engage your own imagination, that yes, just sitting alone staring at a wall is boring. But if you're outside taking a walk, it's not necessarily boring if you don't have a podcast to listen to. I mean, humans managed to have pleasurable walks for many centuries before the age of electronics. So I actually
think, though, that your chances for epiphany could go up by listening to Face to Face. I just want to toss that out there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and then go for a walk afterwards.
There you go. Yeah. Point well taken. So Is that the biggie? Is that the really the big lesson, the most important takeaway? I mean, it's certainly one of the many threads I see in your writing, is this idea of stepping back and listening.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, exactly, because it's one of those things where we have a tendency to react to the environment and to our daily lives, where it's like something happens and then we automatically react to it. And we don't stop and mindfully consider, well, who could I be in this moment? What other opportunities are there for me to respond in a thoughtful way? And also doing this, engaging in these opportunities to allow our minds to deliver an important message to us. Because if we're constantly plugged in via some type of distraction, whether it be a TV or radio or cell phone or internet or whatever, we're not listening to what's going on inside our own heads. And that is what sudden insight is you got a message from what was inside your own head. And if you're constantly blaring other noise, you're never going to be able to hear it.
James, do you have to do this in a community to some degree? So of course you walk out in the woods on your own. Do you need a partner? Do you need a friend? Do you need a team, elders around you, a mentor?
I would say in most cases, you're better off being alone. Because if you're having a conversation with somebody, conversation is great, but again, you're in a distracted state, where someone is demanding your attention via their conversation. If you're walking with somebody and you're not talking, you're just walking hand in hand, enjoying being in proximity to one another, then yeah, that can work fine. But it's when you have to engage, like I'm having a conversation with you right now, I'm probably not going to have some sudden insight right now because I'm thinking about what it is that you've just told me. And I'm thinking about what it is that I have to say next.
Sure.
Being in that state of just, you know, out in nature where, you know, we see the research has been done that shows being alone in nature, enhances creativity. They have scientific evidence to show that this is the case. And this is all about enhancing your creative thought, because we're looking for the answer to the question of our lives, or either all of it or just a small part of it. And that's how we're going to find it, is in this type of – it's not going to happen when you're scrolling through Facebook.
How come – so – believe it or not, we're coming to the near to the end of the interview, which I can't believe. And I knew as I suspected, I knew we were going to barely scratch the surface on this stuff. I love this kind of conversation, and the revelations to me, you know, they bubble to the surface one after the other. Do we really need any more motivational books?
I would say yes, because I wrote one. Go buy it.
That's right.
You know, When I got into writing about health and fitness 10 years ago, I started that because I became the writer that I wanted to read. At the time, 10 years ago, I wasn't really impressed with what was out there. There was a lot of BS. There was a lot of, you know, group hug, you can do it, go girl, Oprah voice on one end. And then you've got the chest thumping testosterone fueled alpha bro stuff on the other end. And I really didn't like it. I just thought, this is obnoxious, or it's just not my thing. And so I started writing for a local magazine. And then within a year, I had a column in the Los Angeles Times, despite, you know, living in Canada. And so there seemed to be a call for that. And, you know, I have to admit, I have not read a lot of self-help books because they didn't really have what it was that I felt that I wanted, which for one was a lot of science. I felt that most self-help books were missing out on the scientific aspect, and they were sort of a rah-rah, you can do it ad nauseum, or then there's, you know, now there's the anti self-help book, but there, and I'm not saying that there aren't any good ones. There actually are a number of good ones that I ended up writing, or sorry, not writing, sorry, reading as part of my preparation for this book. But I wanted to write something that was, you know, well written and amusing and funny and sarcastic and had a bit of profanity in it, but also was very well grounded in science, that explored a unique idea. And the thing is that the human brain is incredibly complex, and psychology is very much a growing field where there's a lot more, I would say, that we don't understand than do. And yes, I think there's lousy self-help books out there that don't really help anybody, but I think that there's a lot of possibility for new ones that if we embrace the evidence and look at what is the science telling us and how can we communicate that effectively to our readers rather than some type of pseudoscientific crap, which unfortunately permeates not just self-help, but many things. I mean, coming from a weight loss background, let me tell you how much pseudoscience was out there.
Oh, yeah. And what a growth industry from different approaches and different fad diets. And this is the one you got to try. Here's the quick fix. And you speak a great deal about quick fixes too throughout. I love your book for all those reasons. I think the narrative, your profanity, your deep sense of humanity as well, frankly, just it's rooted in, here are my observations. I've read a lot of books. I've made a lot of connections. I love the connections. I think it makes it very authentic.
I'm glad that you appreciate that. That was one of the things that when I started writing the book, it was one of those things that just sort of made me feel like I'm not going to hold back who I am and what I believe, that there are some – it's certainly a very liberal-leaning book, that I interviewed Catherine Switzer about her decision to change the world in terms of getting more women into running. So that's a very pro-feminism type of message. There's a woman who had a sudden epiphany about her gender identity. So I think, you know, your typical – Ford Nation voter or whatever might not appreciate that, and I don't care. And there's the stuff about eudaimonia, where it's not just about being happy, it's about having a purpose in life that is not just something that is valuable for you, but can help make the world a better place. So I'm very encouraging of people doing things that aren't just for themselves, but their community at large, that, you know, I think that, you know, we can all be better people, not just for ourselves, but for others.
Absolutely. I love that. What a beautiful way sort of to come to almost a close in the interview. No, it really is. This is about self-help, but it's also about reaching out into the community, into the world. And that's kind of the work that I'm involved in. And so I love that. And like I said, I hope you sell a million copies. So, quote, just because from chapter 9, nudging toward the leap, and we've got to wrap it up here in a couple of minutes, but here James Fell in let me get the subtitle right, How Lasting Change Can Happen in an Instant, the holy S moment, just because epiphany is something that pops in doesn't mean you can't plan for it, both mentally and practically, preparing yourself for life-changing insight to arrive. You may not be able to determine when it will happen, but there is plenty of strategic work to be done to skew the odds regarding if it will, close quote. I mean, it's a real sort of, I think, after our conversation and reading the book, I think it's a real affirmation and frankly, a real challenge to listeners out there to roll up their sleeves and dive in, it seems to me.
It's certainly an enigmatic event, that it's not a like a blueprint for building a house where at the end of it, you have a house. There is...
Fair enough.
You know, we're making our best efforts and we're crossing our fingers and hoping for the best. I did design the book in such a way that, okay, if you go through it and even, you know, years later, you never had that life-changing epiphany, the steps that you go through are still valuable. It wasn't a total waste of time. And I also, you know, I like to think that maybe you learned some stuff, some science and had an enjoyable read at the same time.
Well, it's marvelous. The quotes, the stories, the narrative evidence that you have, frankly, is more appealing to me as a philosopher and a film lover than the scientific data that you bring to the table. But I love what you've done with the book. It's, let's call it what it is. It's The Holy Shit Moment by James Fell, How Lasting Change Can Happen in an Instant. James, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show, David.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.